Category C4, Magazine Programme, Moncrief.
Now, it's kind of handy you're in today because there is a story in one of the papers, this kind of survey they did about men and their perceptions of size in the sides of their bits. And the problem seems to be because you'd think that it's like that, you know, when the, you know, the girlfriend or the partner will go, oh, that's tiny. That actually isn't the problem. The problem is that when they're in after sports, when they're in the changing room, that's what they're worried about. They're worried about the teammates, you know, having a look at it going, mother of God. Have you found that?
You really picked the important topics for us too.
Well, that is a very important topic. Yeah. I'm going to be asking Jesus about this too later
on. Well, do you know the difference is why, and they're saying that, you know, guys worry more about what the fellas think, than what the girls, because the fellas would tell them. You know what I mean? That you're exactly that. The guys will go, you're freaking hell, where is it? Or, know, or the opposite. Or the opposite. Now, obviously, I have never had this problem, clearly.
Of course, clearly, yes. Yeah.
And, but that is half the reason, because guys in a scenario like that will take the mickey out of each other and will say it.
Literally,
now,
really.
One thing that has to be stated, when you're out exercising, and you are doing whatever you're doing to the limit of your abilities, the last thing your body is thinking of is keeping your man in a decent, healthy shape.
The blood is diverted.
Correct.
Let's put it that way.
It's going everywhere else. Yeah. So there is a problem when you do go to have a shower. Your body still probably hasn't thought of your self-confidence yet. It's still probably trying to recover. So it can be like as if you've been stuck out in the polar region wearing just swimming trunks for a while.
No one's looking great then really at that point.
Unless you're hung like a bloody donkey.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I would imagine that
lads usually give out about guys like that.
If you are, isn't that a bit of a disadvantage?
In what respect?
From a playing rugby point of view, that there's a sort of bulky thing, you know, hanging there that you have to kind of strap up and keep out of the way and not have some fella in a rock try to pull off.
A good tight pair of underpants would probably sort out that problem.
Would you not wear a cup of some sort?
A cup?
When you're playing? No.
No, this isn't cricket or American football, for God's sake. No.
But you know the way, like, there's always this eye gouging and biting and surely you'd be worried about that area as well.
No, well, if someone went to bite down there, there could be total a new scandal all the way through rugby if there was an epidemic of penis biting during games.
Well, it could, it breaks and there's some random mickey lying on there. Who does this belong to now?
No, absolutely not. That is one of the areas that is certainly off limits. Even so much so, like, there has been guys now who've got rake down there. Now we're getting off the point here a bit, but I know guys who have had essentials and everything torn by a stud.
Yeah.
And there's a very famous instance where Buck Shefford, who's the All Black number 8, really ridiculously hard man, playing against France, and they tried to get him off the pitch early because if they could get rid of him, he was the captain, the All Blacks weren't half the side, and they shooed him and they tore open the balls pouch.
Oh, Jesus.
And he stayed playing on until about, you know, just into second half, and then he eventually had to go off. He knew what had happened, and he eventually, look, I have to go off, and the French won the game. But like, you can imagine, like, he looked down, there was one of the lads hanging out,
literally hanging.
Tuck tape, okay, we'll keep going. Yeah.
Okay, that's. Yeah. I don't even.
I don't know how we got to that.
That is tough. That is seriously tough.
That's a different league altogether. But you know, that's as far as running back to the other team, the last thing any rugby player is thinking of is what his fella is doing.
Yeah, well, no, that's true. But then, so the slagging that might happen in the dressing room, does it go on for a while, or you know, you turn up, you have teammates, they have a look at it, few jokes, and then everyone forgets about it, or is it like every bloody day of training they're going, look at that.
Like, no, you could come in on a particularly cold day and you might say to yourself, bloody hell, I had to go rooting for it today. But it'd be normally when if there's one lad who is hung, like, these are the jokes I obviously got all the time. That would come up at a later point. Probably not. Bloody hell, look at that.
So you'd know, though. This is like the, and I assume this is like the secret of the confessional, that all rugby players know the other rugby player, like that, you know, someone like...
Well, that's where the great equaliser theory came in. Did you ever hear that?
No.
The great equaliser?
No.
No? The great the great equaliser is when a lad that is hung extremely well, right? When he's with whoever he wants to be with, that just stands up.
Yeah.
And they get going.
Yeah.
But the great equaliser is the lad whose normal size, it's hidden away, it grows and it grows, and that's the great equaliser. It grows. The other one just fills up. This one grows.
I think, though, you'll find some are just bigger than others.
Oh, crap.
I think that's...
No doubt about
that's
that.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah, you just lied to about the size that it grows to. Oh, it never stops. It just keeps going.
That is the wit and repartee that happens in rugby dressing rooms. Shane, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks very much for doing
to go through the serious points of the day.
That's Shane Byrne there. We'll be back with the news.
Moncrief. We're here in Schaefer's bedroom, and we've got the pseudochrome out. We've got everything ready, baby wipes.
Okay, so this is the changing mat, these are the wipes, and there's pseudochrome. So hang on, let's get...
A whole box of nappies.
Yeah, so she'll go through 6 or 7 a day, maybe.
We've got the nappy there, and Schaefer threw it on the ground.
Yeah, she likes to do that. Okay, so she once you put her on this changing mat, she is going to throw those wipes off. She's going to try to get the pseudochrome and throw that off. She'll try to eat the pseudochrome. She's throwing the nappy again. Uh-oh. She only has a couple of words, but uh-oh is one of them. You've never changed a nappy before, right?
No, I haven't. I know that's embarrassing to admit.
She's going to kick and squirm, and she's going to, like, look, she's already thrown that down again, right?
Where did she get that from you?
The mischievousness? No, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what I was like when I was a baby. Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
My name is Hamish McKean, Henry's father. One of the benefits of being a father is the enormous pride one has in one's child. Life-changing experience, not to mention changing nappies. In our day, Pampers hadn't been invented. Nappies consisted of toweling, and we'd have to fix them with safety pins. So one had to do this very, very carefully, especially if a child was wriggling around, which they normally were. Conscious of the danger, the safety pin, and damage it could inflict on the child. You're on a learning curve, and it's fairly steep. Trying to cope with lack of sleep. We'd always have nappies to clean, rinse, then soak, and then wash. And at the time, we were living in the country, and there was no drainage, so we were on a septic tank, so that had its own unique problems to deal with.
Peppa Pig probably is a decent analogy, like, you know.
What's Peppa Pig's dad like?
He's not very smart.
Because you're a dad, and you don't need a license to be a dad. Anyone can be a father.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, maybe there should be a license required.
Daddy Pig is sitting in his favourite sunny spot.
Ah, what a perfect day for doing nothing.
Daddy Pig loves doing nothing.
Fathers are generally seen as father comes home at 5, hangs up his hat, has his dinner, and then maybe might read a bedtime story. But now you have a lot more stay-at-home fathers, and you have a lot more fathers who are really, really hands-on. I think now they deserve a lot more credit than they had before.
My nephew, baby Leo, when I call, I just get to see the nice bits and then I leave again.
It's just relentless, you know. So you're going to get up in the morning, you're going to get up at around 7 o'clock, and then they have to have your breakfast before you can even think about having a cup of tea or your breakfast, unless you want to get up before them, but you want to sleep as much as you possibly can. And then the days that you're so tired and you're finished work, if you had a really hard day, you have to be in good form, you have to collect them on time, you have to bring them home, you have to get them dinner, so you don't ever really get a minute to yourself, and you have to be prepared for that.
My father was one of those who went out to walk. And, like, you didn't ask him for anything, you asked your mother. No matter what you wanted, you asked your mother. You never asked your dad for anything.
So he wasn't really around much?
Oh, he was there all the time. He was there to rule the roost, if you like, because I had all brothers. So, of course, I seen a different side of my dad than, say, my older brothers would have. He was the one who my mum used to say, wait till your father gets home.
You were okay, he never gave you a smile?
No, not me, no, no, not at all. I was the apple of his eye, like.
Okay, so she's about to have a tantrum, so this actually is going to be really difficult. So I'd have the other nappy ready to go. Make sure that you hold her at all times, okay? Because if she rolls off that, you're in trouble, okay? Yeah. So just undo the nappy.
All right, so I'm trying to undo this nappy. I've never done this before. Schaefer, I'm so sorry.
There you go.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I only...
Oh, no, just fold the nappy down.
Fold it down, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. You can see there's poo.
Yeah, there's poo. There's lots of poo.
You want to wipe her first, okay?
Wipe her first, yeah. Okay.
Lift her bum up.
Lift the bum up, yeah.
Okay, so lift her bum up by the legs. Yeah. Now, hold on to her the whole time.
Hold
right?
on, yeah.
Wipe the poo till it all comes off. The poo's kind of stuck to her. Yeah, but it's stuck to her skin, right? So, so describe the smell there.
Sweet shampoo pooey smell, if that's pooey.
Yeah, it's quite thick and sludgy, isn't it?
There's a lot of poo.
You see, there's poo on her back side as well, right? Okay. Do you see where it's all stuck there?
Yes, yeah. Oh, there we go.
Okay, so you're going to have to get that off. It's about to fall.
Okay, the nappy is really, really full.
The, see the poo there? It's actually it's fallen onto the changing mat.
It's quite dense poo and it's sludgy. And
she's dipped her bum in the rest of the poo. A big bit of poo just came off her bum there. Look.
Oh, look, there's some more. I didn't see that.
Yeah, see, that's where you got it all over the mat. She's looking at you now like you've made friends. As soon as you change the poo with the baby, she's your friend for life.
We've been saying AJ Miller was a fairly regular guy. He's Australian. He used to work in IT. He married a woman called Mary. Then in 2004, he finally admitted to himself what perhaps he had known all along, that he's Jesus, the Son of God reborn. And as luck would have it, his wife Mary is in fact Mary Magdalene. The holy couple now live in a compound near Brisbane with some of their followers. And Jesus is on the line. Or AJ, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Well, actually, I suppose I should start. Do people still call you AJ now, or do they call you Jesus?
Well, most people still call me AJ. Most people are pretty uncomfortable calling me Jesus.
When did you first start to get these memories?
When I was around 2 years old, actually, I first started getting the memories, but I didn't really know how to handle them at the time. So I've had memories all through my life, but it was only when I was when I was turned 40, in fact, that I started to realise what all these memories meant.
And were they coming back to you in kind of little fragments?
Yes, I suppose the way memories come back to most people is through fragments, and it depends upon, you know, what you're able to emotionally process as to how much of your memories you can actually retain. And so that's what happened with me. As I emotionally processed through these particular memories, I finished up having more memories and then more memories again and so forth. And so until it's become now that I've had memories of lots of the last 2,000 years of my life. So very clear memories about my first century life and what happened when I was in the spirit world and what happened when I came back.
Do you have memories prior to that?
No, none whatsoever.
The memories say after your life on Earth. What do those memories consist of?
Well, they consisted of what happened as soon as I died, as soon as I was crucified, and watching my wife and my mother bury me, basically. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, spoke to people in the spirit world, because when you're a spirit, you can speak to anybody in the spirit world easily. So I visited people in the hells of the spirit world right the way through to what you would classify as the heavens of the spirit world. And also talk to large groups of people about the truth that I was teaching on Earth at the time.
What does the spirit world look like?
It depends very much upon your condition in love as to what it looks like for you. So the spirit world, if you could picture it as different dimensional existences, all separated by boundaries of love. And if you are in the same condition of love as the boundary is, then it means that you can actually live in that particular condition. So for a person who passes from Earth who's not in a good condition of love, the hell they live in, which is actually a physical location, is not a fiery place of torment, but it is a very dark and dingy, smelly place that mirrors their condition of love. If a person's in a brighter condition of love, then obviously the circumstances they live in also match their condition. So they live in a paradisaic kind of conditions. And then there are places that are unimaginably beautiful, that are almost impossible to describe based upon the condition of love that you receive and what you live in those locations.
And if you're living in a part of the spirit world where your condition of love isn't so great, can you improve things for yourself? Can you trade up?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Of course you can. God always gives people the opportunity to redeem themselves and to grow. So God is constantly allowing, through the laws that God has created for the universe, has constantly allowing people to grow and change. And so, yes, you can improve your condition, and you can also degrade your condition.
Oh, can you? All right, okay. So even in the spirit world, it's pretty much the same as here, then?
That's correct. You can arrive in the spirit world in a better condition than if you then make some bad choices. You can degrade your condition in the spirit world just as you could here on Earth.
Are you God? I mean, this is a kind of a theological question, I suppose, because different Christian beliefs have a different attitude towards that. But are you God, or are you just you the Son of God?
Well, I'm just a normal human being, and in the same way that you are, the only way in which I became a son of God was through this process of becoming at one with God in the way in which God expresses love. And I called that condition in the first century at one-ment with God, or being born again. And once a person becomes at one with God or born again, they become at one with the way that God demonstrates love. But that doesn't mean that they are no longer the son of a human, that they're no longer human, and no longer the son of a woman and a man. And I was never born of God or begotten by God, or there was no virgin birth. I just was born the same way that everyone else is born, and conceived the same way everyone else is conceived. And the reality is, every single person who's ever existed, and also every single person who lives in the spirit world currently, has the ability to become at one with God, and therefore become a son of God.
And so why are you back now, Jesus?
Well, the main reasons why I'm back, there are a lot of reasons why we decided to come back. But the primary ones are, we wanted to illustrate to people on Earth the importance of exercising their will in harmony with love rather than in disharmony with love, and the benefits of doing that, what personal benefits that you have doing that, but also the benefits that you bring to the planet by doing that. And so that's one of the primary reasons. Another reason is that there are many false teachings about me on the planet, and we wanted to correct those particular teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And also we find that there are many people who do not understand how to have a relationship with God, and there are a lot of theories about the relationship with God, but very few people understand how to develop a relationship with God in a practical sense.
From that, could I infer that it's not the end of days? Because an awful lot of Christians think that when the second coming happens, then it's pretty much curtains for the earth.
That's right. No, it's definitely not the end of days, as far as I'm aware. I don't know everything, as I've pointed out. Only God knows everything that's going to happen in the future.
Okay.
And I'm just a person who, like yourself, who has opinions about the future but doesn't necessarily know what will happen. And so, yeah, it's not the end of the days. There's not going to be, as far as I'm aware, any apocalypse. However, there might be quite severe changes on the Earth due to different factors. Because we are, as a planet and of people, damaging the Earth. And as a result, God's put into place these laws where everything that gets damaged generally goes through a process of self-correction. And so there is a potential of damaging things happening to the Earth, but I don't foresee any apocalyptic events that cause the death and destruction of all humanity or any of those kind of things.
Can you perform miracles?
Not at the moment, and in the first century I couldn't perform miracles either until I became at one with God.
Mm.
And so, and the main reason why is, when you become at one with God, then God can express his love through you, and that's what actually performs the miracles. So I expect, when I become at one with God in this process that I'm going through at the moment, which may be 4 or 5 or 10 years' time, I don't know when I'll complete the process, then I do expect that I'll be able to perform similar miracles, or even better miracles, in fact, than the ones I performed in the first century. But to me, they're not me performing the miracles. They're basically just God working through me.
Mm. Actually, about your first century memories, there's a bit of a gap in the Bible from about, I don't know, 12, 15 years of age until 30. Where were you all that time?
Well, there was a gap up until 12 too. From the time of my birth, or two years of age through to 12, I was living in Egypt, and then we came back via a boat to Israel, and eventually went back to the hometown of Nazareth, which is where my mother's family were.
Mm-hmm.
And my father began a building business there, and I worked with him as a builder. I learned how to be a carpenter, but he had a lot of different building people working for him, stonemasons and other people. And eventually he had quite a large business. But when I was around 18, I started to realise that I was searching for the what I called the Messiah at the time, and then and by the time I was 18, I started realising that perhaps that Messiah was myself, and so I started having to go through a lot of changes that I went through with God from the age of 18 through to 31.
That's all we need, Sean, a former building contractor that thinks he's God. Well, that was the big news, that like for between the ages of 12 and 30, Jesus worked as a building contractor. We don't know where. We don't know, like, are there shopping centres in the Middle East that he's responsible for? Or, you know, they'd be kind of slightly run down now, or were they a bit dodgy? What does Big J do on Father's Day, seeing as he's his own father too? Yeah, there's so many questions. We could have had him on for hours, but obviously there just wasn't that time.